Okay, we're beginning here on the bottom of Mem Hei Amud Bet, right after the Mishnah. The Mishnah is discussing the issue of a person who divorces his wife, either Mishum Shemra or Mishum Neder, about what are the requirements or restrictions about taking back that woman. So the Tana Kama says, Lo Yachzir, whether it's Mishum Neder, whether it's Mishum Motzi Shemra, cannot be Machzir. Amar Rabbi Yossi Bar Yumei, Amar Rabbi Nachman, Vahu, Shamar La Mishum Shemra Ni Motzi Eich. That he says that I am sending you out because of Shemra, Mishum Neder, Ani Motzi'ech. I am sending you out because of this Neder, Kasavar Taimamai. What does he think the reason is here? Mishum Kilkula. So the problem here is when he identifies, when he clearly states the reason for the divorce, then we worry about the fact that if the information is found to be false, or somehow he regrets then having divorced her because it's just not true, then if he stated explicitly that that was the reason for his divorce, then we have to worry about kilkul. Imamar lo hachi matzi mekalkelo. If he stated it explicitly, then it is an embedded tenai in the statement that he made, and therefore he could technically reverse the gerushin, which would be problematic for us, and that's what we have to protect against. Ilo, but if he doesn't state it explicitly, lo matzi mekalkelo, he can't ruin the gerushin because he never stated anything. He never stipulated anything in the gerushin. Tosfot over here says, "Yamar lo hachi matzi mekalkelo." Even if he states it explicitly, Tosfot says he doesn't have a right to undermine the gerushin or to reverse the gerushin. He says, "Nira de chashasha zo eina ki im laz bi alma." It's just that he could cast aspersions on the get. Veloshia mamash get batel ubanei menzerim. It's not that he can really undermine, nullify the get, and then cause the children that she had afterwards to be mamzerim, because he does not explicitly cause it to be a tenai. He doesn't say, almanat, on this condition, I am divorcing you. Gadama duchte, even though, as Tosafot himself says in many places, that mahani giluyadat, that as long as you make it clear, or it's obvious what your intentions are, we don't make you say, almanat. As long as you clarify or make it clear why you're doing something, like why you're selling something, why you are engaged in this activity, then we assume that it's an embedded tenai in the activity. Over here, hacha leka lemeimar hachi, over here we don't say that, we don't make that leap of faith. Midabai the Rabbi Meir, tenai kaful. Because Rabbi Meir requires a tenai kaful. V'kach nira delo ati elalaz be'alma. And therefore, we think it only comes me'az be'alma. Rabbi Meir, who would have been the author of this Mishnah, meaning Stam Mishnah Rabbi Meir, as well as the fact that the Gemara is going to bring a Braita that supports this understanding, which somehow equates Rabbi Meir with the Tana Kama's position. So Tosafot says that Rabbi Meir is of the mindset that you need a Tanai Kaful. You need a Tanai when you make a condition. The condition has to be like that of Gad V'Ruvain, and that you have to say, if this is so, then yes. If it's not so, then no. And you have to explicitly state that in order for it to be a tenai. Therefore, we don't make this leap of faith that if you stated the reasons for the divorce, that automatically that's an embedded tenai in the divorce. And that's why over here, Tosafot believes that it's not in actuality that he could undermine the gerushin. It's just that we're worried about the fact that he starts casting aspersions on this get, on this divorce, that we worry about because it would be unpleasant for the woman, and people tend to believe these things, and therefore it would cause problems for the children that are born afterwards. So that's what we say. No going back. There's no reversing this. Once you divorce her, you should know this. And then he can't make the claim that I made a tenai, I only did it for this reason. Even if you do it for this reason, we're telling you that this divorce will be permanent. Right? Whereas if you look at the Tosafot read, as opposed to the Tosafot thinks that the statement here is enough of a statement that it actually would be considered a tenai, that would actually be considered a condition, and therefore it's not just simply laz about the get, but rather it is really that the get would be batel, and that's a real fear here. As the Rid says, we only say there is no such thing as giloy dat begitin when the giloy dat is done after the fact. But over here, where he preempted with the giloy dat, that giloy dat is considered to be an embedded tenai in the get. And even if the husband himself doesn't make the claim, we would make the claim for him because it really would nullify the get. It would undermine the get here. And if the get is undermined, then you have a problem. So what we do is we make sure that the husband knows when he divorces her, there's no going back on this. That he has to have gemirat hadat, that when he divorces her, even though he's stating the specific circumstances under which, or conditions under which he's divorcing his wife, they will be irrelevant, because we're telling him you cannot take her back afterwards, and that will govern over here and not his condition or his gilui hadat for the reason why he is divorcing her in this situation. So the Tosafot of the Reed believes that this is a real statement because he makes it obvious why he's divorcing over here. That would be full-fledged t'nai within the get. The only reason it doesn't work is because we tell him it's not going to work. But had we not intervened, had we not had this takana that tells him you can't get remarried, we would be faced with the problem of kilkula, which is that he can undermine the get. Ike de amre, that some say, Amar Rav Yosef bar Yume, Amar Rav Nachman, Tzarich shemar la, Havi yodat, Tishum shemra ani motzi'ech, Mishum neder ani motzi'ech. Not that if he would say it, we'd run into a problem, but rather we make him say this. I want you to know, I'm divorcing you because of the shemra, I'm divorcing you because of the neder. Kasavar tai mamai, what is the reasoning behind this position? Kedei shloye benot Yisrael prutzot bariot uvenedarim. The whole point of this divorce and making this divorce permanent is to set a precedent, an example of this woman that if you get involved or mixed up in these issues, that's going to land you in a divorce, but not only a temporary divorce, a permanent divorce. And so therefore, we make sure that he states the reason for the divorce so that she knows that this whole divorce is happening because of that behavior, as well as other people will take note of the fact that this is what happens when you behave in this manner. So here you have a machloket amoraim in Rabbi Yosef bar Yume in the two lishonot that we have here as to what is the reasoning of the Tana Kama. I see Tosfot over here says, Hani Trey Lishne de Rabbi Yosef Aliba de Tana Kama Plige. They argue within the position of the Tana Kama as to what is the reason we don't allow you to get remarried. What is the reason that we make this into a permanent divorce? And there are others who disagree with the Tosafot that say that this machloket here within Rabbi Yosef ben Yumi applies to all the Tanaim, maybe excluding Rabbi Yehuda. And therefore, later on, it'll be easier to explain why the Gemara brings a braita of Rabbi Meir to prove the position of the Tana Kama, because we believe that they all are of the same position. It's a question about the details of that position. And Rabbi Meir and Rabbi Elazar are not arguing fundamentally on the Tana Kama. They're just arguing about the circumstances under which this takana is applicable. The first reasoning is mishum kilkula. We worry about the fact that maybe there's some sort of embedded t'nai in a divorce that is resting upon rumors, or resting upon a neder which he thinks cannot be unwound. And therefore, if we find out in the end the rumors aren't true, or that the neder could be nitara yedei chacham, that would undermine the divorce, whether in reality, like Tosafot Reed says, or whether just to cause laws like the Tosafot, that would cause problems later on. And therefore, we make sure that he knows that when he divorces her, this is a permanent divorce. According to the second Lashon, the problem here is pritzuta. We don't want women acting in a promiscuous manner. We don't want women engaging in nidarim. And therefore, we say, if you engage in this behavior and your husband comes to divorce you, that divorce will be permanent. So no, we're not playing games here. It's not just like, oh, the rumors come up and we can squelch the rumors. If you get involved in this and this is the behavior that you engage in, then you're going to end up with a divorce that is permanent, that cannot be reversed. And so that's why we make him state explicitly the reason for the divorce in order to squelch this type of behavior, in order to be an example that these women should not engage in this type of pritzut. That's why he says, Hilkach, Tzarich lemeimar lo, hochi. That's why he has to tell her why he's divorcing her, so that it's clear and that it's obvious what the divorce is happening for, in order that she recognize and then others recognize the reason for the divorce over here. And obviously the nafkamina between these two different shitot is, number one, if he doesn't say this language, according to the second shita, Beit Din compels him to say this language. But according to the first shita, if he doesn't say the language, then we don't worry about kilkul. Number two is, if he does remarry her despite the takanat chachamim, in the case of pritzuta, where Beit Din is imposing the restriction against getting remarried, then we would force him to divorce in order to maintain that takana because of pritzut. On the other hand, in the case where it's mishum kilkul, if he remarries bidyavad, we might leave him in that marriage because no kilkul can come from it anymore because he did remarry her. And we can't speak about annulling the get in another marriage because there is no other marriage. It's his marriage again to her. So now, Tanya Kalishna Kamo, Tanya Kalishna Batro. We have a breita that supports each one of these versions. Tanya Kalishna Kamo. We have a breita that supports the Lishna Kamo, which is Amar Rabbi Meir. Mipnei ma amru amotzi et ishto mishum shemra lo yachzir, mishum neder lo yachzir. What is the reasoning behind when a person divorces his wife because of these rumors that are circulating, or because of the taking of nidarim, lo yachzir, he cannot return her, he cannot annul the divorce. Mishum shema telech v'tinase leacher, because maybe she will go, get married to another individual. V'nimtzu dvarim badain. And then we will say that the whole thing was false. The premise of the divorce was not true. V'yomar, and he will say, ilu hayiti yodea shekeinu, had I known that this was the circumstances, these were the facts, afilim ayunodim li mea maneh, even if you gave me 100 maneh, maneh is 100, so it's 100 times 100, 10,000 coins, lo hayiti migarsha, I would never have divorced her. V'nimtzu get batel, ubaneha mamzerim. You see, then that would cause the get then to be annulled, and then her children from the second marriage would be mamzerim. Again, according to Tosafot, that's just figuratively because he would make these claims. According to Tosafot Rid, it means literally that he could annul the get. Therefore, we make clear to him, you should know, that a person who divorces his wife because of shemra cannot return her. This is a permanent divorce. Mishum leder lo yachzir. And it's for another, then he may not return her. Now, according to Tosafot, where the Machloket Amoraim before was about the Tanakama's position, here we just brought a Braita that is Rabbi Meir's position. So how is it that we're bringing a proof from Rabbi Meir's position to the Tanakama's position? Rabbi Meir appears in our Mishnah. And appearing in the Mishnah, it makes it sound like that he is not the Tanakama, because it says Rabbi Meir Omer, so Rabbi Meir appears in the Mishnah, and he has an opinion. We have a braita here that tells you that the reason for Rabbi Meir's position is Mishum Kilkula. And that's pretty obvious in the Mishnah that Rabbi Meir is worried about Kilkula, and that's why he worries about a neder that has Hatarat Nidarim associated with it. That Hatarat Nidarim can cause us a problem because the Baal can then claim, I didn't know that there was Hatarat Nidarim. And if I had known about that, then I would have never divorced her. That's a problem of Kilkula. So you bring a Braita that says Rabbi Meir thinks that the problem here is Kilkula. That's right. Rabbi Meir definitely thinks the problem here is Kilkula. Why does that reflect on the Tanakama? Or why is that a Braita, a proof to the Tanakama's position if we think that the statements of Rabbi Yosef Ben Yamumi and Rav Nachman are made about the Tanakama? And you bring me a braita about Rabbi Meir, who's later in the Mishnah, who has nothing to do with the Tanakama. So the question is, why is the Gemara bringing this as a proof, if that is the case? Many explain that the braita that we brought over here speaks about two scenarios. It speaks of a scenario of a neder, and it speaks of a scenario of motzi shemra. In our Mishnah, Rabbi Meir only addresses one of those two issues, and that's of neder. It's clear that Rabbi Meir in the Mishnah is not talking or speaking about pitzuta. He's speaking about neder because his whole problem is maybe there will be a hatarat chachamim, and that would undermine the marriage because the guy will say, I didn't know that could have a hatarat neder here, and then it'll be mishum kilkula. The fact that the braita mentions not only neder, but also motzi shemra, that shows you that Rabbi Meir's position here is not only about his position in the Mishnah, but rather must be reflective of the Tanakama's position in general. It's true that Rabbi Meir believes mishum kilkula in the Mishnah, but that's with regards to neder. Here we see Rabbi Meir also says that Mishum Kikula applies to the Motzi Shemra aspect. The fact that he mentions both of those items for us could be a proof that this is the position of the Tanakama, because Rabbi Meir does not address Motzi Shemra in the Mishnah, and therefore when he mentions it here, it must be reflective of the Tanakama's position. It must be Rabbi Meir saying, this is the position of the Tanakama, and I agree with the Tanakama with regards to this point. Okay, regards to the other point, I want to differentiate between when there's an ability or necessity for Hatarat Nidarim versus where there's not. But then you see from here that Rabbi Meir's position, Begadol, is about Kukula, and that must be reflective of the Tanakama because he mentions Motzi Shemra as well. Then the Gemara says, Tanyo Kalishna Batro. We also have a Braita that supports the latter explanation that our Mishnah is Mishum Pritzuta. Amar Rabbi Elazar b'Rabbi Yosi mipnei ma amru amotzi et ishto mishum shemra lo yachzir. How come we say that if you divorce because of these rumors, umishum neder lo yachzir, or because of nidarim, you may not take the woman back, you may not reverse this divorce? Shelo yehu b'not Yisrael prutzot b'arayot u'b'nidarim. It's explicit, because we don't want the women acting in this way, or carrying on in this manner. Fikach, umrim lo. Therefore we say to him, emor la, declare to her, make it clear to her, abiyodad mishum shemra ani motzi'ech, mishum neder ani motzi'ech. Make it explicit the reason for this divorce, that the reason you're getting divorced is because of shemra or because of neder, so that she knows that that precipitated the divorce over here. And this type of behavior will result in a divorce and a permanent divorce, and therefore we force him to declare the reason for the divorce in order to be a deterrent against this type of behavior or this type of pritzut. So those are the two views of what the Tanakhama's position is. Either it's that mishum kukula or mishum pritzuta. When it comes to the latter part of the Mishnah, over here, as Rashi stated in the Mishnah, there are Rishonim who disagree with this, that Rabbi Yehuda believes that the whole problem in the Mishnah is mishum pritzuta, and then Rabbi Meir and Rabbi Elazar, who are the latter opinions, only worry about mishum kilkula. It's obvious that the later Tanaim, as to what the reason is behind their positions, whereas for the Tanakhama, it's unclear, because the Tanakhama makes more of a generic statement about this, just that if you get divorced for this, it's a permanent divorce, but doesn't explain what the reasoning behind that is. It could be mishum kukula, it could be mishum pritzuta, and that leads to these two opinions within Rabbi Yossi Bar Menume as to what the reasoning is behind the Tanakhama. But once we reach the later Tanaim in the Mishnah, each one of them, it's clear what their position is, which is Rabbi Yehuda Omer, kol neder sheyadu bo rabim lo yachzir, shelo yadu bo rabim yachzir. Any neder that's widely known to the public is problematic and she cannot be returned. Shelo yadu bo rabim yachzir. If the people don't know about it, it's not widely known, then he can be machzir. Over here, as Rashi said in the Mishnah, Rabbi Yehuda is not worrying about mishum kilkula. If he's worried about mishum kilkula, then it would be just the opposite. Because the neder shehuduar birabim, and here, assuming that, like the Rishonim that say that means aldat rabim, that he took a neder, it's an irreversible neder. So if that's the case, then there will be no hatarat nidarim, and then we shouldn't have to worry about it. But Rabbi Yehuda says just the opposite. In the case where it's a public neder, there we do worry about it. When it's a non-public neder, then we don't worry about it. So it's clear he's not worried about kilkula, but rather mishum pritzuta. And what is the pritzuta here? Pritzuta is either one of those two things. Either since she did it in public, that is a pritzut that is unacceptable because she took the neder not privately, but out in the public. Or the fact that she took a neder that is irreversible, that's even a higher level of pritzuta, I mean that her neder here is going to be stuck and permanent. That's a level of pritzuta that we cannot accept, because she did it in such a manner that there will not be any hatarat chacham, and that is an extra level of pritzuta. So for one of those two reasons, the neder birabim is considered to be a pritzuta, and kukula, Rabbi Yehuda does not worry about. Amar Yishu ben Levi, my time with the Rabbi Yehuda, what is the reasoning behind Rabbi Yehuda's position? Dichtiv, because it says, v'lo yikum b'nei Yisrael, ki nishbu'u lahem nisiei aida. It's talking about the Givonim. When b'nei Yisrael came into Eretz Yisrael, the Givonim tried to pull off this trick where they disguise themselves and look like that they are a nation from outside of Canaan, trying to establish an alliance with B'nai Yisrael. And they fool B'nai Yisrael into making an alliance, and it turns out that they're not foreigners, but rather locals, and they're one of the Amim inside of Eretz Canaan, and they create this alliance with B'nai Yisrael. And it says there, B'nai Yisrael did not kill them because they took a shvu'ah, the Nisiyei Eda, the leaders of the community, took a shvua and entered into an alliance with the Givonim. So now, Rabbanan, hatam michala shvua ilavayu. Klau. The Rabbanan say, what are you talking about? Who says that the shvua was effective at all over here? Came into Amru Lahu me'eretz rechoka banu. Since they stipulated as part of the nether, we came from a faraway land, velobo, and they didn't come. Lo chayla shvua ilavayu klau. The shvua is not effective at all. It's a ta'ut, a mekach ta'ut. It's a shvua b'ta'ut. And that the whole premise of the alliance was false. And therefore, there is no shvua over here. V'hai delo katlinhu. So then, why didn't B'nai Yisrael kill them? Mishum k'dushat Hashem. Because of the possibility that it would be a chilul Hashem if they did abrogate the shvua. First of all, with regards to Rabbi Yehuda's position, Rabbi Yehuda believes that the shvua did take effect. Or that the shvua was in effect. And therefore he says that they couldn't violate the Shua, that's why they didn't kill him. Rabbi Yehuda's proof is from the fact that the reason given in the Pasuk for the fact they didn't kill them is because Nishbalahem, because they took the Shvua. And the Shua is the premise, or it seems to indicate that that's the underlying reason why they didn't kill them. But that means that according to Rabbi Yehuda, had the Shvua not been Chal, if it was a reason to say that the Shvua is not in force, then it wouldn't have been a Chilul Hashem to not abide by the Shvua, because there is no Shvua. On the other hand, the Chachamim here say, even though the Shvua is not Chal, the fact that Bnei Yisrael gave them their word is important, and therefore there would have been a Chilul Hashem if they did not stand by their word. As Rashi says over here, Shelo Yomru Ovdei Kochavim Avru Al Shvuatan. So that it's a appearance issue. It's not that they're obligated to keep the Shvua. It was clearly a false Shvua, and the alliance was premised on lies. But that doesn't change the fact that other people looking in look like there's an alliance. The perception that there's an alliance here, if they abrogate that alliance, that would cause a chilul Hashem, or cause people not to believe that Bnei Yisrael stand by their word. Now, if you think about the circumstances, it's also very important. You have a nascent nation entering into Canaan, about to enter into its really first real battles inside of Canaan, and then they establish an alliance with a party. If they abrogate that alliance, even though, again, it was based on a lie, nevertheless, it's important for them to establish their nemanut, their believability, their credibility with regards to standing up to an alliance. And so even though maybe there is no Shvua here, the perception is very important in them establishing their credentials as a new nation and people who want to then make alliances or join with them. So that's the way that Rashi seems to indicate what the problem is, or the Kedushat HaShem. On the other hand, Tosafot over here discusses an issue as to whether they were allowed to create an alliance with the Givonim altogether, and whether, according to Rabbi Yehuda, says there is a Shvua here, or according to the Chachamim, say that there is no Shvua because there was a lie, is that really the reason the Shvua falls apart? Or maybe the Shvua falls apart because it's a Shvua, that is, a Shvua le-vatel et ha-mitzvah. The Shvua that would cause you to be mevatel the mitzvah, which is the mitzvah to wipe out anybody who lives in Canaan. Torah explicitly states that you have to wipe out all the inhabitants of Canaan, and here this Shvua would prevent them from doing such. So that's what Tosafot asks. Vim tomar, v'lo v'ochi mi'chai l'shvua, v'avi nishba levatel et ha-mitzvah. How does this Shvua take effect? Forget about there was a lie. Even if they were telling the truth, could they have come into an alliance with them had they told them the truth? Because it's mevatel the mitzvah lo techayeh kol neshama, that you may not leave anybody in Canaan alive. Tosafot over here takes a position which is argued amongst the Rishonim that Bnei Yisrael, when they entered into Eretz Yisrael, was there an opportunity for the people of the land to sue for peace? Was there an ability when they entered into land for the people of Canaan, the Shiva Amamim, to sue for peace? Now, that may be in one of two ways. Either that they vacate and they leave the land, or that they accept fully the sovereignty of Bnei Yisrael over them, and they forego Avodah Zarah, would they have been able to stay there? So Tosafot plays around with that because that's important here. Because otherwise the Shvua wouldn't have been effective, irrespective of whether the Givonim were lying or not, because they made a Shvua with someone who they couldn't make a Shvua with. And therefore, Tosafot says over here that maybe Kodim Shavru et Yarden, prior to their crossing of the Yarden, there might have been an ability to sue for peace. It seems like once they entered into Eretz Yisrael, there was no room for making peace anymore. But he says in the end, it seems like that lo techaye neshama is only if they are not willing to make peace, they're not willing to accept the sovereignty of Bnei Yisrael. And that is the way that Tosafot concludes why the Shvua would have been effective, or why the Shvua could have gone into effect had it not been for the lie that was involved in it. But Tosafot in the end seems to indicate that the Psukim do not corroborate that Givonim were coming to make peace or to accept the sovereignty of Bnei Yisrael, and therefore their Brit wasn't premised on those factors, and therefore it might have still been problematic. Whereas the Ramban believes that in Ochanami they could have made peace, and that the peace was fine. The only problem was that it was done through trickery. And the trickery, or the underlying assumptions, were the problem here, or the failure in the Shvua. and not the fact that this is a shvuah levatelet a mitzvah that annulled the shvuah. So Tosafot seem to believe that the shvuah was annulled because it was a shvuah that you can't take because it's against the Torah, versus the Ramban and others who believe that the failure in the shvuah was the fact that it was based on a false assumption. Now Rabbi Yehuda obviously believes that the shvuah took effect because it's a neder birabim, and a neder that's done birabim cannot be reversed, cannot be undone. And that's why Rabbi Yehuda also believes over here, a neder of the woman that's done birabim cannot be unwound. Now again, whether the pitsuta is the fact that it can't be unwound or that it was done in public, but either way, a neder birabim has a unique standing, similar to that neder of the gimodim that was done birabim. And therefore, even though there was something wrong or underlying that neder, there would have been a chilul Hashem if they did not stand by their word. All right, so now Gemara says, v'kama rabim. What does it mean that take a neder al dat rabim? Nachman amar gimel. Nachman says three people is considered to be a rabim. Yitzchak amar asara. Yitzchak says 10 people. Nachman amar gimel yamim bet rabim gimel. Nachman says three is considered to be rabim because by the psukim, by a zavag dola, over there it says that if she has a blood flow for yamim rabim, so what does it mean yamim rabim? Rabim here, we're defining the word rabim. So yamim already means two. So rabim already means a third. That tells you that the definition of the word rabim is three. And so therefore, when you talk about a neder al dat rabim, it means that it's in front of three people, and that's considered to be a neder rabim. Yitzchak amar asara, it means 10. Dichtiv eida. Because here in the pasuk it says, the nesiei ha'ida were the ones who entered into the covenant or this alliance with the givonim. And the word eida in the Torah is already defined, that we know from the meraglim, which is armatayla yidara azo, that this eida, where we mentioned by the meraglim, which are the 10 meraglim that came back with the Lashon Hara al Eretz Yisrael. And then we have a connection from that to the Adat Korach. And then from Adat Korach, we have a Gzer Shava over V'niktashti B'toch V'nei Yisrael, there of Kedusha. And from that, we learn out that a minion is needed for Dvarim Shebi Kedusha. And over here too, the word Eida, when it says Nisiei Eida, will be defined as a minion. And therefore, Rabim is a minion. So here they argue about what is considered to be a Rabim, both for what is considered to be a Neder of that Rabim, as well as what's considered to be a Rabim for Pritzuta here. And Neder is 3 or 10. Rabbi Meir Omer, kol neder shetzarich hatarat chacham, any neder that requires a hatarat chacham is problematic and lo yachzir. She'eino tzarich hatarat chacham, if it does not require a tarat nedarim, then you can be machzir, because then we don't worry about this problem. So Gemara says, Tanya, Rabbi Elazar Omer, lo asru tzarich, elo mipnei she'eino tzarich. Rabbi Elazar says the opposite of Rabbi Meir, and he says, no, it's the other way around. The reason that they said by a case of Hatarat Chacham that you can't do it is only because of the case where there is no Tarat Chacham. But my kamiflege, what is the machloket here between Rabbi Meir and Rabbi Elazar? They both clearly believe that the problem here is kilkula, which is that we're afraid that the husband afterwards is going to regret the divorce and say, I didn't have all the information. But why do they have a differing opinions? The answer is, Rabbi Meir sabar, Adam rotzeh shetitbazeh ishto v'beitin. Rabbi Meir believes that a person is willing to drag his wife out to beitin and have her be nitbaza in public in order to get the hatarat nidarim done. So he's willing to drag his wife out, take her to Beit Din, take her to the chacha to get a hatarat neder. If that's the case, then our biggest fear is a neder that has the possibility of being nitar ayidei achacham. Because it's being nitar ayidei achacham, therefore he'll have to drag her out to Beit Din, and he could say, I regret divorcing her, because had I known that I could have gotten a Hatarat Chacham over here, I would have taken her out to Beit Din and forced her to get a Hatarat Chacham, and I would never have divorced her. Therefore, the Kilkula is that fear that there is Hatarat Chacham. In the case where there's no need for Hatarat Chacham, whether that's because Petach Bitzido, it's so obvious that the Neder would fall away even without Hatarat Chacham, or it's a case where the Baal could be Mefer the Neder because it's Inui Nefesh or Devarim Shebeino Lebeina. Over there, you can't say after the fact, oh, had I known, he should know. Hafara is something that he can do, and he knows that he can be made for the nether. Hatarat Chacham is something maybe that he didn't know, or wasn't aware of the fact that, first of all, it could be done, or the fact that there was a possibility that he could come up with the Hatarat Nether over here. So that's why Rabbi Meir believes that our fear is a case of a nether where there could be a Hatarat Chacham. Without that, we're not fearful because the fact that he divorced her, he can't come up with an excuse later and say, oh, had I known. He knew. Either he could have done hafara, or the neder was not chal because it was so obvious that it wasn't chal. There he can't have regret. On the other hand, Rabbi Elazar Savar, Ein adam rotzeh shetit baza ishto bebeitin. That a person does not want his wife to be denigrated in such a manner that she's dragged out in public to beitin. He'd rather that he divorce her than take her to beitin to get hatarat neder. Therefore, Rabbi Elazar believes that here, if he finds out about hatarat neder, that won't help him. Because even if he knew that there could have been a hatarat neder, he still wouldn't have taken advantage of it because he wouldn't take his wife to beitin. Therefore, our biggest fear is a case where he doesn't have to do hatarat neder. Case where he could have done hafara, and since he could have done hafara, he goes, oh, had I known I could have done hafara, then I would have never divorced her. So Rabbi Elazar allows for that claim that he could have done hafara, as opposed to Rabbi Meir, who sees that as not being a valid claim. Rabbi Elazar says, even if he just says, I didn't know about hafara, that's a good enough claim to come and undermine the marriage. And because of that, we also said by the case of Hatrat Chacham, that it doesn't work, not because inherently he would be able to know it, because we won't believe him in that case, because we know he doesn't want to take his wife to beit din. But because of the other case, where he doesn't have Hatrat Chacham, it could be done through Hafarat Nedarim, therefore across the board we said, anytime you divorce for a neder, that's a reason where he could undermine it, and since he could undermine it, not going to let you remarry in those situations, because in a case where he could have done Hafarat Nedar, he'll regret it. A case where I could have had Hatra Chacham, even though the regret won't matter, we want to be consistent in our din that you can never return a woman when there is a nether involved in the divorce. Amar Rabbi Yosi Rabbi Yudah Maseh Bitzidan. The end of the Mishnah, there was this case law. And that case was somewhat problematic because the Mishnah says, Mipnei Tikkun Olam, they allowed him to return her. Which seems to be just the opposite of the whole theme of the Mishnah, which is we don't allow for a person to return her because of Tikkun Olam. My Tana Diktani Maseh. What is going on here that the Tana all of a sudden brings down this case law? Chasuri Mechsera, the Mishnah is missing the transition between the previous positions and this case law, which is Hachitani. But Me Dvarim Amurim Bishinidrahi. When is that true? When the neder derived from her. Of a nadar Ihu Yachzir. If he took the neder, then he can return her. But Amar Rabbi Yosi Rabbi Yehuda Masen Nami Bitzidan Bechad Shamar Lishto Kunam Im Eni Migashich. I take a nether that if I don't divorce you, v'girsha, and then he divorced her. V'tiru lo chachamim shiachzirena mipnei tikkun olam. Then the chachamim allowed him to take her back because of tikkun olam. My konam, what exactly was the nether that he took over here? The problem with the word konam is that I am osera myself something. Over here there's no object to his konam. It just says konam im eini megashich. I will be the konam if I don't divorce you. But it never defines for you what exactly are the obligations of this neder if he doesn't divorce her. So that's what the Gemara says. What's this konam? So I'm Ravuna, Bomer, Yasru, Kopero, Shabalam, Alai, Imeni, Megashich. All the fruits of the world will be asur to me if I don't divorce you. Meaning that the konam is about another object that makes it untenable for him to remain in this marriage. And therefore, he must divorce her because of the neder. And that's why over here we allow him, first of all, to divorce her. But then we also allow him to take her back. Now, it's obvious that they would allow it. Maybe we should make a gzera of Rabbi Natan. The time Rabbi Natan mer no der ki ilu bana bama. Someone who takes a nether as if he's building a bama, as Rashi says, b'shat isra bamot, at a time when it's not allowed to bring korbanot outside of the mikdash. And the one who upholds the nether is even worse. Not only did he build a bama, now he's makriva korban on it. Kamash malan, that we still allow him to divorce her. By divorcing her, he's upkeeping the neder. So we would think that there's something negative in keeping such a neder from Rabbi Natan. If we remember, we saw this Rabbi Natan back in Yevamot and Nidarim, and the Ran there in Nidarim explained to us that what is this issue of building a bama, which is that sometimes you do something that looks like it's positive. It looks like you're doing extra credit. It says, bring your korbanot in the mikdash. This guy is so excited to worship Hashem, he wants to bring korbanot in his backyard. So he thinks, you know what? I can do something extra. I'll do a bonus. Not only will I bring a korban in the mikdash, I'll also bring a korban outside the mikdash. But little does he know that bringing a korban outside the mikdash is something negative, not positive. So what looks like positive turns out to be negative and turns out to be worse than not doing it at all. And the same thing with neder. the way that a neder works, you have the restrictions, the laws of the Torah, and this person's adding on additional laws, additional restrictions. So again, it looks like he's doing a good thing by adding on these additional restrictions. But no, it's just like a bama, which is that these additional restrictions turn out not to be too good, but rather bad. Adding on these nidarim is a negative aspect, and therefore we deem it like he built a bama. And if he carries out the nether, it's as if he brought a korban on that bama. He went even further, and not only did he build it, but he actually carried out what he thought he was going to do. And that's the negativity associated with the nether, and we spoke about it more in depth when we spoke about this in the nidarim. But for that reason, we would think that we would dissuade this individual from keeping his nether in order to divorce her. But that's what the Gemara says, Kamash Malan, we allow him to divorce her in order to clear this nether. Bipnei tikkun olam, my tikkun olam ika. What tikkun olam is there here? And Rav Sheshet Aresha. The tikkun olam is a dangling modifier. It's not modifying this case law at the end of the Mishnah, but rather the whole Mishnah, the beginning of the Mishnah, which says lo yachzir, all those cases where he cannot remarry her, that's what the tikkun olam refers to. Ravina amar olam aseifa, it's going on this latter case. V'achitani in bezu mipnei tikkun olam. It's saying mipnei tikkun olam means that here it was not subject to tikkun olam because it was he who took the neder and not his wife who took the neder. The reason why here we differentiate between the case of the husband who took the neder and the wife who took the neder could be for one of two reasons. The Ramban suggests that the reason is that the nature of his neder was very different than the neder of the woman, which is that his neder expires as soon as he gets divorced. Meaning that once he divorces her, he's mikayim the neder, and now the neder doesn't exist anymore. So therefore, if he remarries her at that point, it's not a problem because the neder now is null and void and gone. On the other hand, the woman's neder was not connected to the divorce. It was a neder that would persist even post the divorce. The other possibility is that when it comes to his own neder, a person can control his own neder because he knows how or what could create a petach l'neder. And therefore, you can't make a claim or there's no problem of saying, had I known. What do you mean, had you known? You knew. You're the one who took the neder. You understand what's going on. Whereas by his wife's neder, he doesn't know all the facts and he doesn't know what could be a petach or not be a petach. And therefore, you could make this statement of, had I known, because he doesn't know. He doesn't have clarity about the nature of the neder of his wife. And that's why it leads to a different outcome. The Tosafot reads, brings another reason over here. It says, Kashar etzmo b'neder shelo yochol leitcharet. Hari anu ro'im shebechol leivu migarsha. Ve'enu chafetz baklal. Sher nedar bechol kocho. Ayadei neder shelo yitretzeima. Hilkach shum kilku enu yochol lasot. So he says that the nature of the neder here is that he must not like her. And therefore when he divorces her, he definitely divorces her with a full heart. And that's why he made the neder. If it's a neder that doesn't relate to the gerushin themselves, it's a neder that causes or forces him to divorce, then the Tosafot read speculates that maybe there we would say, mishum kikula, even by a man's neder, just like you would by a woman's neder. The problem here is that his neder is directed at the gerushin, which makes it clear that he wants to divorce her. Now that wouldn't be true even if the woman took a neder that was directed at the gerushin, that even though she wants the divorce, doesn't tell you that he really wants the divorce. And our whole problem is that he might regret the divorce. So the nature of the neder over here indicates of his full-heartedness in the divorce. And that's why over here we don't worry about kukula. But if he had taken a neder where he could have regrets because neder caused him or forced him to divorce her, not because he wanted to divorce her, because of the nature that he took, then maybe over there we would worry about kukul as well. So that's what the Tosafot read says with regards to kukul, that we don't worry about kukul because over here he divorced willingly and knowingly, whereas in the other case, it was because of these outside factors that the wife brought into the situation that forced him to divorce her, and there he might have regrets. But that works all for the reasoning of Kilkul. With regards to Pritzuta, why don't we penalize the husband just like we penalize the wife? And there the Tosafot read makes the statement, "Davka shenadrahi kansua shlo tia prutza b'nedarim. Shenadrahu ein the kanso shenedarim b'ishahim pritzut b'lo b'ish." The Tosafot read makes a simple statement that there's a difference between men and women. And that when it comes to women, we see this as being a pritzuta. By men, we do not see nidarim as being a pritzuta. He doesn't define why or what the reasons are, but it's interesting that he just makes that simple distinction between men and women as to being when it is or is not a pritzuta. And now, next Mishnah says, "Motzitzi shtomi shum ailonit." Person that divorces his wife because she's found to not be able to bear children. She doesn't show this simanim, the signs of maturing and becoming a full-fledged female. Rav Yehuda Omer, lo yachzir. Rav Yehuda says you may not return that wife if he divorces her this way. V'chumim omrim, yachzir. The chumim say, no problem, you can remarry her. Niseit l'acher, v'ayula banim hemenu. She married another party and then has children from him, which basically undermines the claim of Ilonit, because the fact that she'd have children shows you, or demonstrates that she's not an Ilonit. V'hi tovat ktubata. So now she goes back and says, I want my ktubah from the first husband because the divorce was on false premises. He divorced me claiming that I was an Ilonit, and because I was an Ilonit, I lost my ktubah. Amar Rabbi Yehuda Omer la, we say to her, shtikuteich yafeh midiburech. Being quiet for you is better than your speaking up over here, because if your claim is accepted, that it was a false premise for the divorce, you should have gotten paid your ketubah, the husband could come back with the statement that the divorce was also on a false premise because I thought you were an Ilonit. And based on that, I didn't want to divorce you, and that will cause her huge problems in her new marriage. So we say, drop the claim, because that claim is only going to lead to trouble for you, not to your benefit. Tosfot asks, okay, so Rabbi Yehuda says that we tell her to be quiet. But even if she is quiet, why don't we come and intervene over here? Because the truth is, there was a problem in this gerushin. The answer he gives is that because the chachamim are mitakein lo yachzir, that he can't return her, that's why shtikuteich isn't a problem anymore, because by definition, when we make the takana that he can't return her afterwards, then there's no unwinding or there's no tznai in the gerushin. And that's why we say that the gerushin were permanent, because that is the imposed condition of a divorce from an Ilonit, according to Rabbi Yehuda. Or, the Baal could argue over here that she became healthy after the divorce, and therefore he doesn't owe her a ketubah, because the only reason she gave birth is because she got healthy or something happened after the fact. And therefore the divorce was on a proper premise, and she's not entitled to her ketubah. So as far as her ketubah is concerned, she wouldn't get her ketubah anyway, and therefore better for her to let the issue rest, because she's not going to get her ketubah, and the only thing he can do is ruin her divorce from the previous husband and cast aspersions or problems with her second marriage. As the Tosafot read says over here, she'afalpi shehodanu lo, she'afim lo timtzai ailonit lo yachzir, v'cholomar mipnei asafek gereshtia, v'lo chashti b'chazirata, natati la get b'cholev. You're right, I divorced her full-heartedly. I knew that you told me that I'm not going to take her back. I had no idea that she would give birth in the future. And then that would cause me to be then chayav in paying for her ketubah. That was the case, I would never divorced her. And that would cause a problem, not because of the Ilonit aspect of it, which already based on the takanat chachamim would not allow him to return her, but because the paying of the ketubah now might cause a regret in the divorce, independent of the Ilonit situation. He says, had I known I had to pay the ketubah, I wouldn't have divorced her. And then that would cause a problem over here, and that's why we tell her to, better to be silent than to speak up in this case, because that could bring us to a position or a situation in which his regret will not relate to her qua Ilonit, but rather to the fact that he now has to pay a ketubah. And that would open up Pandora's box as far as regret with the get and problems with her new marriage. Well, we have two issues here. First of all, the fact that the Mishnah states here that an Ilonit needs a get. Why does an Ilonit need a get? Rashi over here says that Ilonit is a din of mekach taot. That when the guy got married to her, he thought she was going to mature into a full-fledged female. And then she doesn't. And that's a mekach taot. A mekach taot automatically unwinds the marriage, not because you have a get, but because the marriage was on a false premise, similar to what we saw about the Givonim, and therefore it should unwind itself. You shouldn't need a get. Rashi says, Mikom akom, tzricha get, ein adam ose bilato bilatznut, ubal v'shem kidushin. Despite the fact that, yes, there's a mekach taot, and yes, this would unwind the marriage, the fact that he had bi'ah with her, a person doesn't make his bi'ah bilatznut, and he came through and he had kidushin despite that fact. And since he has kidushin despite the fact, he needs a divorce, he needs a get over here. Tosafot, on the other hand, suggests that the nature of the Ilonit over here is that we're not sure. She's showing some simanim of Ilonut, some simanim of not. And therefore, there's a certain amount of certainty surrounding whether she is or is not an Ilonit. And that's why she needs a get, because we're not going to let her go free because of Mekach Ta'ot, because we're not certain she's an Anonit. On the other hand, for Ktuba, it's a Motzi Michavero Alav Araya. She would have to prove that she's not an Anonit to get her Ktuba. So therefore, she needs a get because of the fact that we're not certain she's an Anonit. But for that same uncertainty, she won't get her Ktuba. Now, the question you have to ask over here, and will become more clear in the Gemara, is how is this different than the previous Mishnah? Why is it in this Mishnah that we don't worry about Kilkul, and yet in the Mishnah before, we do worry about Kilkul? So some suggest over here, like the Balei HaTosafot, the issue of Ilonit is unusual. It's something that does not occur very frequently, and because it's not Shkiach, we don't either worry about that, or because it's not Shkiach, then most people don't divorce because of that reason. And therefore, if they do divorce, and that is an unusual circumstance, we assume that they divorce with a full-fledged divorce, because otherwise he would have kept the woman, he would have kept her as his wife. The Memra, the Rabbi Yehuda, Chayish leKukula. From our Mishnah, it makes it sound like Rabbi Yehuda worries about Kukul. Then we just hear the opposite in the previous Mishnah. The reason that he would say over here that you can't be Makzir is clearly not because of Pritzuta. Ilonit is not an issue of Pritzuta. It's clearly an issue of Kilkula. And the fact that he says lo yachzir, you can't remarry her, means it's mishum kilkula. Yet in the previous Mishnah, we saw that Rabbi Yehuda's position was he didn't care about kilkul, he only cared about pritzuta, the tnan, amotziyat ishto mishum shemra, lo yachzir. Umishum neder, lo yachzir. Rabbi Yehuda omer, ko neder sheyadu bo rabim lo yachzir, shelo yadu bo rabim yachzir. Rabbi Yehuda clearly made the stipulation that the problem here is mishum rabim, which is a pritzuta issue and not a kilkula issue. Alma, from here you see that Rabbanan Chayish leKukula, Rabbi Yehuda lo Chayish leKukula. Rabbi Yehuda in that previous Mishnah does not worry about Kilkul, and yet the Rabbanan do worry about Kilkul. Amar Shmuel Ipuch. Flip our Mishnah over here. Flip the positions in our Mishnah. Ba'amikdani Seifa. What are you going to do with the latter half of this Mishnah? Nisei Le'acher, Vayula Banim Emenu, Ve'itovat Ktubata. Amar Rabbi Yehuda Omer La'shtikuteich Yafeh Midibureich. Michlau, the Rabbi Yehuda Chayish leKukula. That he's telling her to be silent over here because her speaking up and making the claim is going to cause a kilkul in the marriage, because the guy will say, I would never have divorced you had I known that you could have had children. That shows you again that Rabbi Yehuda believes that kilkul is the issue. Hanami ipuch. Flip that as well. I mean that we flip our entire Mishnah over here and say that all the positions are reversed in our Mishnah. Abaye amar l'olam lo tipuch. Rabbi says, no, don't flip our Mishnah in order to deal with this issue. Rabbi Yehuda, ba'ayi savar laki Rabbi Meir, v'savar laki Rabbi Elazar. He holds like Rabbi Meir, and he holds like Rabbi Elazar. B'tzarich, savar laki Rabbi Elazar. B'she'enu tzarich, savar laki Rabbi Meir. So he holds like Rabbi Elazar in the previous Mishnah, who says that a person does not want his wife to be embarrassed and baited, and therefore he'd rather not get the hatarat neder and stay in the divorce. So in the case where you need tzarich hatarat tahat chacham, he holds like Rabbi Elazar, and here he says, I would have regretted it had I known that it would be matir neder. We don't listen to him, because no person wants to bring his wife to Beit Din and be mitvazeh kacha. The case of enu tzarich, in a case where he doesn't require hatarat chacham, he holds like Rabbi Meir, who says that there's no regrets with regards to hafara. If you could have done hafara, or you could have annulled the neder yourself, because petach imo, we don't give you a second chance later and say, well, I didn't know. Ignorance of the law in that case is not a good claim, according to Rabbi Meir. And if you didn't do the hafara at the time, you lose out. And that's it. You can't go back on it. So he holds like Rabbi Meir in that case. And therefore, in neither case does he think you have a problem of kilkul. Because like Rabbi Elazar, we don't expect a person to bring his wife to Beit Din. Therefore, the hatarat chacham will never be an issue of regret, because he'll never take his wife out to the Beit Din. As far as when there is no need for Hatarat Chacham, over there Rabbi Meir told us, and he holds like Rabbi Meir in that case, that forgetting or not knowing that you could do Hafara isn't a reason or a basis for regret. And that's why Rabbi Yehuda in the previous Mishnah says that Kilkul is not a Chashash at all, even though he thinks Kilkul is an issue over here. Because in the previous Mishnah, no regret will bring you to a position where you could claim that it would have done otherwise. He wouldn't have done otherwise either because he wouldn't have taken his wife to Beit Din. Or he wouldn't have done otherwise because we don't give him the opportunity to do otherwise. When he says, had I known I could have done hafara, that's not a valid excuse in terms of reversing or annulling the get. Now obviously for the chachamim, you're going to have to say just the opposite, which is that the chachamim before believed that there's a possibility of kilkul, And over here, they don't believe there's a possibility of kilkul. And that's what Amar Rava, the Rabbi Yehuda kasha. You only worried about resolving the steer and Rabbi Yehuda, the Rabbanan lo kasha. What about the Rabbanan? Now, if you do the ipuch and you flip their positions, then you solve the issue for both parties. You solve for Rabbi Yehuda and you solve for the Rabbanan. According to Abayu, since you don't flip the positions and there's a difference between the previous Mishnah and this Mishnah, you only explain why there's a difference in Rabbi Yehuda's position. You didn't explain why there's a difference in the Chachamim's position. The question between Rabbi Yehuda is not a problem like Abayi already suggested. There's a difference. Man Chachamim. Who are the Chachamim? Rabbi Meir. Damar Beinan Tnai Kaful. Pachavai Eskinan Belo Kafle Tnai. And over here was a case where he wasn't Kofel his Tnai. And over here, again, now you would have it just be the opposite, which is that in the case of the previous Mishnah, he made a Tnai Kaful. And in this Mishnah, he did not make a Tnai Kaful. Again, why would you make such a distinction? It might be because of the nature of the divorce. The reason that to assume that there was a Tnai Kaful in the previous Mishnah and no Tnai Kaful over here, the Ritva suggests that there's a difference between the Mishnayot, is because in the previous Mishnah, he wants to make it clear that the premise of the divorce is her misbehavior, is her taking the darim, is her motzi shema, the promiscuous behavior. And therefore he makes that Tnai Kaful to make it absolutely clear that the reason for the divorce is her behavior. In the case of our Mishnah, where he thinks it's a permanent status, once someone has a physical problem, the physical problem is not going away. This woman is not at fault. It's a physical reality. The physiology of the woman is what caused the problem, not anything that she did. And therefore he doesn't go out of his way to make a Tnai Kaful explain the nature of the divorce, because in a sense it's self-evident why he's divorcing her, but also because it's not her fault that he's divorcing her, it's just the reality that they have to face. And that's why over here there is no Tnai Kaful, whereas in the previous Mishnah he might have made a Tnai Kaful. But that leads to a different outcome, which is that in the previous Mishnah where there is a Tnai Kaful, we have to worry about Kilkul. In this Mishnah where there is no Tnai Kaful, we don't have to worry about the issue of Kilkul. Alright, next Mishnah. Person who sells himself and his children to non-Jews, in essence, putting themselves into quote-unquote captivity to a non-Jew, we do not redeem him. But we do redeem the children after the father passes away. Now, which is interesting, Rashi over here says that's because as long as the father is alive, he will protect the children or insist that they remain Jewish and that they keep the mitzvot. Our fear is that once he dies, that shmirah or that impetus will be gone, and therefore we intervene to take care of the children. The other possibility you could have argued is that the penalty is on him. And therefore we're going to see in a second in the Gemara that he's a repeat offender. And since he's a repeat offender, that's why we do not redeem him. So therefore we want to penalize him as long as he's alive. The children who were not the offenders, once he's out of the picture, we're willing to deal with the children because the offender is gone. And that might be the other possibility of the reasons here. And that's the number of Asi. That is only if he did it once, twice, and a third time. That means the first two times we redeem him without any questions asked. Even though he himself put himself into that predicament, we help him get out of the predicament. On the other hand, when it gets to the third time, now this guy is what we call a repeat offender, and we can no longer keep expending money to help him out of these difficult situations. We say one time is maybe an accident. Even two times we'll say that he got involved in this. By the time he goes to a third time, this guy has a chazaka already of doing or acting improperly, and therefore we're not going to redeem him anymore. We're going to leave him in that situation until, again, he passes away, and then we'll deal with the children. Hanu b'nei bei mechsei. So there were these individuals from such a place that borrowed money from non-Jews. And they didn't have the ability to repay it. So they came and took them into captivity, basically the equivalent of debtor's prison. They incarcerate them because they didn't pay their debts. Now they don't really incarcerate them. What they do is they take them as slaves to work so that they should pay for the debts by the work which they do. When you can't pay the bill, they make you wash the dishes in the back to pay for the bill. It's the same thing over here. He is making them pay the bill by taking them as avadim. Atu the kamei d'ravuna, amalu mayim v'duchu. What am I going to do for you? Detnan, there's a Mishnah. Umucheret atzmo, Ved banav lovdei kochavim in pudinoto. Person who sells himself to an ovei kochavim, we do not redeem him. And over here, you did the equivalent. It was a forward sale, because you, at the time that you took out the loan, you didn't actually sell them, but in the end, you were collateral for the loan. And since you were collateral for the loan, you effectively sold yourself to an Oved Kochavim. Amalei Rabbi Ava, Limatani Rabbeinu. So here, he wants to mention to Rav Huna that he made a mistake. But he doesn't say to him, you made a mistake. But rather he says, Rav Huna, didn't you teach us? That's only true when he's a repeat offender. So Amalei, Hane, Mragle, Rigile, Da'avdi Hochi. These guys were repeat offenders. It's not the first time he borrowed money from the non-Jew and ended up in this predicament. And therefore, you're right. If it had been the first time, we would go in and redeem them and help them out. Mm-hmm. But in this case, where he's a repeat offender, we're not going to go in and help him. Or you could argue that Miragle Rigile means that this is the conventional way to deal with people who default on their loans. And therefore, this person should have considered this possibility up front that he might end up in this predicament, that anybody who borrows money in this way may end up in quote-unquote captivity or enslaved to these individuals to repay their loans. Therefore, we can't come and rescue him or be podeh him if it's something that he should have taken care of up front and is considered a pusheya when he enters into such a transaction that lands him in the hands of a goy. We can't then be responsible to redeem him in that case. How gavra the zavin nafshe leludai? This individual sold himself to the ludai. Ludai, as Rashi mentions over here, he mentions in other places in Shas as well, that the Ludai were a cannibalistic tribe or society. So here, he sells himself to these Ludai. He's not in good hands. He could be dinner tomorrow or the next day. So Ata the Kamei Rabbi Ami, Amalei, Pirkan, redeem him. Get him out of there. Amalei, Rabbi Ami says back to them, they quote our Mishnah about Podim et Abanim. So he says, listen, that reason that we don't redeem them over there is because we're not afraid of kilkul. We're not afraid of something going wrong. On the other hand, after the father dies, we worry about the kilkul of the children, and we go in and redeem the children. It's a kavachomer. If we worry about a case of kilkula, then the ultimate kilkul is that he's going to be dead, and that they're going to kill him. In the case of danger to life, we have to intervene and redeem him, even though he's a repeat offender, and even though we shouldn't be redeeming someone like this. And from here, we might have evidence of the fact of what Tosafot said yesterday, that by the case of Sakanat Nevashot, that's an override to the restriction against redeeming captives, Yoter Mikdei Mehem. Because here too, we see that we would have accepted from this position about redeeming an individual in this circumstances because his life was in danger. And so being in danger might be a primary concern when it comes to captives, and then all the other takanot fall by the wayside. But this is obviously in a situation where the individual didn't put himself in a predicament that would obviously result in death. But if he puts himself in that danger knowingly, then the din might be different. And actually over here, when he sold himself to Ludai, it's not clear whether he really understood that he was going to end up in a position of death. Amrulei Rabbanu Rabbi Ami HaYisrael Mumarhu. This guy is not a regular practicing Jew. This is a guy who ignores halacha and he eats nevelot and trefot, and therefore he's a mumar. If he's a mumar, you have no obligation to redeem him from these individuals. Let us not say that he is a violator of halacha because he doesn't believe. And because he doesn't care about the halacha, it's just that he is drawn or he has a huge appetite for this type of thing, and he is violating it because he can't control his desires. Rabbi Ami says, why don't we say he's a mumar l'teyavon and not a mumar l'hachis? That he doesn't have a fundamental problem with the religious precepts. It's just that he can't control himself in the face of these religious precepts, and then maybe we should redeem him. Sometimes we see that he has kosher meat and non-kosher meat in front of him. And yet he still eats the Isser meat, even though he could have taken kosher. So that case, that's not Mumar L'Teyavon. Mumar L'Teyavon is only when I have no option to get kosher meat, then I opt for the non-kosher stuff because I have such a desire for it and I want it so badly. Or because the non-kosher is so much cheaper, therefore I'm going to buy it instead of the kosher meat. But in a case where it's equally available to him, it's the same thing, kosher, non-kosher, and you pick non-kosher, That's clearly a mumar l'achis. That means that you don't care about the halacha. It's not simply that your desires are overriding your wants to keep the halachic precepts. Over here, the assumption is that the heter and the isur were exactly equal, and yet he still picks the isur. All right, if there was a different type of meat, there was a different type of sauce on it, and he really liked the other one, then you're still talking about a mumar l'te'avon, because he's not making the decision because of the fact that it's isur. He's making that decision because he has a desire. That's a mumar l'te'avon. Here, the problem is that it's equal options, and he still picks isur. That shows a disdain for the halacha, and shows that he doesn't care about the halacha. He says, sorry, I can't help you out over here. I can't redeem you because they're not letting me redeem you. Meaning that he's saying that the other people are not letting him redeem him, but really what he's saying is that your behavior and your activities caused the problem. First of all, you sold yourself in voluntarily. And number two is you were a mumar lahachis before this. So how can I come in here and protect you when you didn't, in the first place, worry about the halacha and worry about your religious beliefs, and therefore we're going to leave him be, and whatever happens to him will happen to him. He made his own bed, now he's got to sleep in it. That a mumar l'achis doesn't have a status like a full-fledged Jew. Now, man, once a Jew, always a Jew, but he loses his status for many items, including here, that we're going to intervene on his behalf and be pote him, which is a burden on the tzibor, which is a very altruistic thing to do, to go and pay for someone else's freedom, especially when he sold himself in. We're not going to do it if the guy does not want to be a part of the klal. He doesn't want to make himself a part of those believers in Hashem and those that keep the halacha. And therefore, I can't redeem you in this case. And we'll stop here by the two dots on the top of Mem Zayin Amud Aleph.